Hello and welcome to the National Q4 Gamer Review. I am DJ.
I am Lewis, and this week we're going to defeat Medicare on New Game Plus again.
Yes, with harder bosses this time. Bullet sponges out there in the hospitals. Well, that sounds bad. I didn't mean that. <I'm not sure. laughs> Please, FBI, no bully. So I have not had any time to play video games recently, but I have been keeping up with news. Have you? It sounds like you're saying you've been playing stuff.
Yeah, no, I've been doing a good bit of gaming. I try for this show to get a more of a wider sample than I would normally do. So I have played a single game a lot, and then for the show I have tried to play quite a few games with varying degrees of success. And to the point of,
I feel bad. I told the guys, our guys who made The Great Rebellion, that I bought it. Of course I'm going to support our guys, but I haven't had a chance to play it. Have you?
No, yeah, I mean, I bought it as soon as it went up for pre-order. That's the one game I pre-ordered. Yeah. And I bought it through their website too, because I'm a big proponent of that.
In my mind, it's sort of like an analog hell book, but I actually do want to play it, and we could do an episode on that.
I don't know if we talked about it last time, but I have played a little bit of it as one of the games I sampled. My big takeaway was that I definitely need to hook up a controller to my PC to do it. It's good, but did not feel great. It didn't feel great with a computer. It was manageable. It was okay. You will enjoy it if you are play a lot of platformers with a mouse and keyboard, but I'm not really a mouse and keyboard platformer. I'm a controller platformer guy.
For platformers especially, I mean, top-down action you can kind of do maybe, depending, like twin stick-ish, or I played Helldivers with a controller, but there are people, I guess, who did it with mouse and keyboard as well. But yeah, platformers especially, no way.
Yeah. So that's definitely a big plus in the controller column if you're going to play it, which is now easier than ever, right? You just hook up your Xbox or PlayStation controller directly to your PC. It's just via Bluetooth. It's very easy. That's kind of a solved problem. Used to be a way bigger pain in the ass getting that working, but now it's relatively easy as it goes. In that vein, I tried to play Robin Hood Sherwood Forest. There's a new Robin Hood game, and I'm a big Robin Hood enjoyer for the usual reasons.
Is this the one with the nigger? Because I saw a nigger in Robin Hood, but it looked like a movie.
No, I don't know if I got to the black people parts, because this is a game that I accessed through the Good Goy Game Pass through Bill Gates's gaming emporium, whatever service that I.
You're funding genocide in Africa.
Something like, or I'm not, and I want to. I don't know how the Bill Gates conspiracy theories go both ways, right? But the problem is Game Pass is, it's for PC now. You can use PC and or Xbox. I'm trying to play it on Xbox, and the game
subscription works for both. Is that
yes.
right?
Oh, yes.
That's cool.
That means you get some I don't want to call it shovelware. I'll call it European AA games, that are AA PC games. It's just not at all optimized for a controller. It's not, or even very well understood how to play it by controller. It's very much tacked on. You control a cursor in menus. It's and then it's first mission is chop down 8 trees and build 5 crafting tables, and I just screamed and threw it through my controller. So I'm not going to – didn't play that one much. I mean, conceptually it makes a certain amount of sense because, you have a hideout, right? But that stuff's just not fun anymore. Building 3 crafting tables, to build 2 hammers, to build a shop to make better whatever is just not an enjoyable gameplay loop.
I would even say that was old in 2020. Like, I don't know what they're doing now.
Yeah, these games all seem to be, like, made in Europe. I think the Europeans just love that shit. It's kind of like, I don't know. It's crack to them, I guess. But, yeah, no, it's very, like, just, like, stops you immediately. You will not have any fun. Anyway.
Cracking table blocks your path. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's just, it didn't seem like, I didn't get into a single fight, but the fight controls seemed off a little bit, too, like, but whatever. I play a lot of games, so we should just table that. The Robin Hood game, if you like those crafting table games, you will like that. And I like Robin Hood a lot. Had no, absolutely, like, zero tolerance for it because of that issue.
He's kind of a national socialist. I mean, I can sort of see that.
I mean, maybe it's based at some point. I don't know. But it was very, very basic. I mean, I talked to Friar Tuck, who's telling me to build, like, oh, well, you got to build a bow. Here's a bowstring. Go cut down 4 pine trees. I was like, shoot me in the head, dude. So, yeah, didn't end up playing much of that one. But that is, like, a very new game. So, you know, look at me doing my job. The game I actually have played and enjoyed is Warhammer 40K Bolt Gun, which is sick, dude. It's actually really, really good.
I've seen so many. Yeah, I'm not surprised, actually. I mean, yeah, no, it looks sick, absolutely.
So it is a, you know, Doom. The genre is being called Boomer Shooter now.
Doom,
I guess
you're about to say Doom Clone. I'm like, okay, Boomer. You don't get the Doom Clone anymore. That's Boomer talk.
Yes, but it is very direct, very, very doomy, more so than, like, yeah. Other.
Well, it even has, like, the pixel graphics thing, right?
Yes, and, like, the three angles. Now they're doing which I enjoy, which is, like, okay, well, they're cheating a little bit, right? They're not actually doing, like, it's not actually designed, you know, you don't need, they're not doing all the stuff you need to make it, like, just 100% doom purism. Like, you can look up and down, you have to look up and down, right? Like, it's a first-person shooter with a Doom skin over it. And
you can look up and down in Dark Forces. I don't know the last game that wasn't the original Doom.
Yes.
You couldn't look up and down.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would tell also, like, in the vein of for this show, I tried to play Quake after playing this because, oh, like, that's an up and down looking game.
Okay.
And I think it was playing Quake 2 because I wanted to give it, like, a fair shake, right?
Well, and, Quake 2 and Quake are very different, but we haven't done a Quake episode yet. We got to get McNabb on. Quake.
Well, anyway. felt like absolute dog, dude.
Quake 2 has problems. Like, it's, yeah.
Maybe I have to go back and think about it. I was like, oh, this is like.
They both have problems, but the problems are very different. I like both of them. I replayed both of them actually not that long ago. I played because they had with, like, the ray tracing shit remaster. I was like, well, I want to try that. I couldn't, of course, turn all of the fancy ray tracing effects on, but it's still, like, ray tracing on ancient games like that actually is a fairly legitimate use case. And yeah, we'll have to do an episode on Quake. It has problems, but I'm curious what your, because to me it was more, the problems were more about essentially art direction, and sameness.
Oh, it didn't feel good. It was, like, kind of, I was on the controller, once again. It just, like.
Well, that'll, yeah.
But I was looking around and, like, this is like I'm like over moving. I'm over moving the cursor. It's not a thing I could get used to. It was hard, but not in an enjoyable way. Whereas Bolt Gun, you are moving, like, fucking fast and you have to move.
Well, that was a critique of Quake 2, even at the time, was Quake was already half a tick slower than Doom, which was very, very fast. And then Quake 2, you're kind of like a bulky soldier type thing. It's a different vibe entirely.
Yeah, it's like a Quake 1. I honestly don't remember. It starts with a big cinematic of you, like, drop potting down on something. I don't know if they're also like that. But anyway.
No, really different. It was actually intended as a, I don't know what you're doing with it. Whatever, it's fine. This is a video game show. But no, that they're completely unrelated. Quake 2 began life as a completely unrelated project and then just kind of got Quake slapped onto it. But you know, the original Quake is essentially Lovecraft with rocket launchers and Trent Reznor music. And the second Quake is, like, kind of low rent sci-fi, you know, soldier goes on assault on alien planet type, just sort of whatever.
I think the second one's with one I played then. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Just to say that Bolt Gun feels like butter. It feels so good. There's a bit of a learning curve. So I've been reading. I read some reviews of it after I played it. I was like, wow, this game is rocks, dude. Like everyone must know this thing rocks, right? But I forgot. I was reading reviews by game journalists, like an idiot, and they didn't understand things like actually. You need to play this game on a difficulty that has like a bit of hardness. I play on Exterminatus, which is like the hardest of the not too insane, you know, levels. And it's like a difficult game, and you have to do all kind of things. But you're changing weapons constantly and moving around constantly, and like it's legitimately difficult. Like you will get thrown into situations where you're just getting hit. Health is utterly non-regenerating. Like obviously no regenerating health. It's doom. And like I'm reading reviews, like, well, you know, the bolt gun, the titular bolt gun, is a very, very good weapon, and you know, the game presents it very well. But all the other weapons, there's no reason to really use them because the bolt gun is so good. And I was like, oh, you play on like baby mode. You like like I can shoot a guy and watch his health bar not go down, like because he's a Space Marine Terminator. Like, dude, we're playing totally different experiences here. And it seemed like the community broadly like had issues with it that are all almost every complaint that I saw was designed with, oh, like, there's no reason to ever use the plasma gun or the shotgun or, no nigga, like I ran out of ammo like a minute into the first big boss fight, like you're gonna be, there's a lot going on. So, there it's very,
why would they why did they say that?
Because they were playing on easy baby mode where you could just shoot it, like you could just take the main first bolt gun and just like it's like a, you know, because you could,
sounds well right.
Yeah, it's like, oh wow, there's not much depth here. It's like, yeah, nigga, like, like I don't know what you mean. Like, you know, you can, if you play on easy, you can just shoot everything with the base damage gun, and yeah, it'll be easy. But then I have people who really liked it. My only problem with it, and it's very minor, is that generally, like, you think a game of this size, we're kind of spoiled that like soundtracks are all fucking like massive bangers for like small games these days, like, you know,
we are spoiled and, with that. Yes, absolutely.
This soundtrack is, it's doing a cool thing where the better you do, the it's like a dynamic soundtrack, gets more complex.
Nice. And yeah, elevated. That's also very mid 90s. That's awesome.
But the soundtrack's not like an absolute banger as a result compared to like say the yeah, current gen Dooms who are yeah. And also like if you're good, it's so if you are, it gets better, but it the soundtrack, as I can tell, determines better by like how much stuff you are killing. But if you're any good, you have to like, well, not any good, you're playing on a hard ass difficulty, you have to, you know, stick and move and then like hide and then stick and move and then hide,
right?
Because if you, yeah. So it's like, oh well, you're bad at the game because, you know, I can't kill an enemy every, you know, second, which is because I'm, you know, playing on difficulty, where if I did that, like, you cannot it is actually like, if you're, I don't say realism, but like very high levels of lore accuracy at the harder levels, like a couple guys with like the basic machine gun will shred your shit if you're not really on it. And you have to, like,
well, that is also kind of doom like. I mean,
yeah, awesome. You can't just like stand and bang unless you're, you know, unless you're getting like, you've unless you're like tailored a circumstance where like, sure, you know, you get a bunch of people chasing you and you like hold a corner or something like that. But yeah, no, very enjoyable game. Very, very 40K. Absolutely, like no story to speak of. There are like 20-second cutscenes in between chapters.
No, not missions. There are orcs, and they need to be killed. Like, what are you talking about?
Exactly. Like there are 20-second like pixel, very nice, very pretty pixel art cutscenes every chapter. Not every mission, between every chapter. It's great. There's also, I don't know, I was playing it later, I did that, but, like, there is just a button, like, it's very modern. Hey, like, where is the next thing to go to? Like, objective
oh, sure,
highlighter?
Right, well, I will say that, yes, having also replayed Doom not that long ago, it was a pain, the backtracking's a pain in the ass, like, in the old school first-person shooter level design.
And it's doing that, it's doing find three keys for a lot of levels, it's doing, like, a lockdown, not boss rooms, but, like, just very hard.
Yeah, hard, speaking of dark forces, yeah. Actually, I mean, that's even, that was one of, I mean, that was, yeah, no, absolutely, that's obnoxious. And it's another artifact, we've talked about this many times, of the era where games, there just weren't that many of them, and they were very expensive, and there was an expectation that you would get your money's worth by stretching playtime, by having artificial barriers that in today's landscape is just which I'm glad that they threw that SOP to players for. Yes, okay, they incorporated in the design, and if you really want that authentic mid-90s Doom clone experience, then you can have it. But yeah, for everywhere else, there's this the up D-pad button or whatever it is.
Yeah. Also, it does like it uses it like it much like the Native Americans use every single part of the controller. And I can so the button for this is like the Xbox chat button or whatever. So I can see maybe why a game journalist wouldn't actually, because some game journalists complain about this. I don't know if this was changed as a patch, or was just always there. The journalists were stupid, but it is like a weird button to press to get it. And there's not a tutorial to speak of at all. Like, it just drops you in. It's like, look up, look down, like walk over to the gun. It picks up. So,
just real quick, and then a totally gaming related, not related aside. I was in a hospital waiting room recently, and the TV was on, and it had some reality. It was like some low rent. It was like Iron Chef, but not. It was called, as I recall, Chopped. And it was with the idea that like you go through a whole, I only saw the one episode, but it seemed like they have, rather than a big cast that you lose one every week, you have five chefs and somebody wins and the prize is smaller. It was like $10,000 or something. Still a good chunk of change, but not, like this. Anyway, so one of the contestants was this just extremely obese woman who she's like, at some point she was like, as a member of the Wampa shampoo drink tribe, my grandma taught me to use every part of the buffalo. And then because the one of the first challenges was Rocky Mountain oysters, bull testicles. And I guess she did well with it or something. But then in the very next challenge, it was like, okay, here's some prime rib, but it's not butchered yet. So, chop it up and cook it for us. And she couldn't fucking cut the prime rib. Like, yeah, I bet your grandma told you all about using all the parts of the buffalo. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, that's funny. I have seen that. Butchery is hard. I'm a big advocate, and then I've stopped doing it. It's a pain in the ass. I used to buy the big chicken wings and then because I have a butcher's knife, very nice. Actually, I can't tell what makes a nice butcher's knife apparent, because it's like just a heavy blade. It may be a shitty butcher's knife. I wouldn't know.
Right.
yeah. But then I was like, actually, like, this is a huge pain in the ass. Butchery is a skill. You definitely gotta have it.
No, it was just funny because she went a rant about the whole thing, and I was like, yeah, all right.
That's what also the good thing that it shows is that there's a lot of chefs out there, so like they can always find chefs that are totally mid, and they go outside. You can't go to your comfort zone as a cook is always a huge pain. I'm a cooking show enjoyer. As I get more into the gym, I've got to do like some more protein autism. As I get deeper into the cut, making cheesecake with no cream cheese, just like an ersatz mix with protein powder, Greek yogurt, and cottage cheese.
That sounds palatable. Delicious. I might have to try that.
It's not as good as cream cheese. Obviously, it's like we're playing with like the definitions here of what is a cheesecake to some degree. And I'm a big, anyway. Well,
vanilla protein powder and Greek yogurt, like, pro tip for those who may not be aware, is extremely nutritionally dense and also quite delicious.
Yes, and the calorie protein ratio, very good also.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's nutritionally dense and, good for gains and,
Yes. I have a few more games, but we can't touch all of them because I've been playing a lot of shovelware. The Game Pass has organizes their games into subgenres. Obviously, if you like this, you might like this. I had some podcasts to burn through, and I was looking, kind of just chilling, and they kind of create a second called Vibes, and I was like, oh, Vibes. This sounds like just it's like your walking simulators. Maybe you're popping bubbles or something like that. Vibes.
Yeah.
I'm a Vibes enjoyer. So, I was you know, I was like, oh, look, I'll do the vibe section. And then there's this game where I forget the name of it. I don't even want to promote it. It was, but I'm sure somebody in the comments will say what it is. And I don't remember the thing, I won't look it up, but it was in the vibe section, which is like happy stuff. Like, it's got the new one I haven't played yet, but it's like a Souls like, but you play like a hermit crab trying to get your shell back. It's like a kind of a Souls like. Yeah.
That actually it sounds like.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun.
I'll say. Yeah.
And I've been trying to play, I've been bouncing off Souls likes like a lot, at least recently, because there's so many of them now. So I haven't played that one yet. I want to like build up some tolerance. And of course, the DLC came out, so that kind of throws that. You know, anyway.
DLC, but there's DLC.
Elden Ring.
That's what DLC. I was about to ask. I mean, yeah. I feel like we've been burying the lead here.
I haven't played it yet. I've been observing the controversy. But first, I do want to tell this story because it is funny. So I go into the vibe section. I find this game where you are playing a person in a boat. It's like Water World, kind of, you know, but it's very cartoony. And there's like monsters, and you gotta avoid the monsters, and like find your friends, or like, and like the monsters are people who are like lonely or have like negative emotions, and it makes you a monster in this world. And you play a person who's like lonely, kind of on the edge of becoming one of these things, and like doing puzzles. And as it turns out, this is the vibe section, which is like all cheery shit. And it's like, oh, I start the game
up. It's like a good vibes section.
Yeah. Good vibes, you know, as I understood it, right? Or, you know, a lot of, you know, the Hermit Crab Souls-like game seemed like a fun vibes game, you know? It's like a lot of bright colors. I get into this game, and it is true, you are, like, doing, like, puzzles, but it's very clear that this is all in your head. It's not ambiguous, right? You are playing a depressed girl in like some unnamed European country, and like the monsters you fight are yelling at you. That's like are like her abusive like parents and family. Like when you die, it's like you're a burden on everyone. It's like wait, like you're eaten by a monster. It's like kind of scary looking, but not very much. But it's just like. Wait, these are not vibes.
Somebody went over the depression quest like thing and was like, "What if we did that for real though? Like, what if we made it?"
Yeah, what if we made it exactly? And it is to some degree like just a Crash Bandicoot tier platformer with like some boat sections, but like the vibes were so off that like I was like not in the mood for this. A and B, like what the fuck, and like it threw me for a loop. I almost want to go back to it, but I have like no desire. Like it's just it wasn't good enough, and didn't have like any fun. And I was like, oh wait, so if I play better? No, it's like you play better, you can avoid these things. No, it's like it's also like a kind of somewhat on rails, you know. So it's like, yeah, actually, maybe this is these. I don't know what this category is, but I don't know. Games about mental illness are a genre.
I was going to say I haven't played it, but I got it for like $2 on Steam, the Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice, and which it seemed intriguing enough. I know it seemed intriguing enough and to have good enough. I was curious, and I saw the sequel just came out, and it's just a very interesting case because the original game was like marketing material that it was an authentic portrayal of schizophrenia. You hear like, you know, the art, the sound direction involves, you know, sort of whispered voices in your ear,
and there's never, yeah, it's like a shamanic thing you're doing with bicameral monitoring. Yeah. There's like right. Legit, there's like, well, there's not science, anthropology, like, exactly. Involved, yeah.
Anthropology, sociology, all this kind of cool stuff. It seems like I'm sure they have terrible liberal politics or whatever, but I was intrigued enough by the premise and seemed competently executed, and I believe it was Ninja Theory, who are a legit developer. So I was like, okay, I'll spend $2 on whatever and hopefully get to it at some point. Anyway, sequel comes out like a month or so ago, and it's the exact same thing except it's played straight. And like, she's still maybe schizophrenic, except also goblins are real, probably. And now she's on a quest to like do some Lord of the Rings shit or something. It's like complete tonal mismatch and what is going on?
Yeah, I feel like also, I don't know, I haven't played the first one either. I got the second one through my Good Boy Pass, but hadn't played the first one yet, so I'm not.
Oh, okay, interesting. So did you like?
No, yeah, not yet. It's on the list. Okay, it's on the list.
Let me know. Yeah.
But I feel like the you watched the that's the seminal 2022 film, The Northman.
Yeah. No, they're clearly.
I feel like The Northman like already did that better than you can do. Like they did very. Yeah, exactly. That so like I don't know if I would okay, I they did that exact thing, but like
why would you play this game? Like what purpose does this serve? Yeah, absolutely.
And I really enjoyed The Northman actually. But so I don't know if I could enjoy this. Maybe perhaps.
Yeah, just like that came out in a very strange moment. It feels like it was 10 years ago.
Also, like once again, like Viking chick is such like a shoot me in the head. Like
Well, that's the thing. That I guess that is the terrible liberal politics, right? It's just the fact that it's a female lead.
You're getting the texture pack to make it a dude, or something like that. Like I don't know. My friend is like reinstalled Stardew Valley, in the base friend chat, and they were like, "Oh, bro, I got you a texture pack for Stardew Valley that will erase all the POC and make them white." Nice. Yeah, based. So. That's the future is now, right? You can the POC removal patches are mods are
in the room with us. The kinds in the new Dune, I'm like, just denegrify. Like this is the easiest AI. Like my denegrify app is gonna, you know, make me millions.
We both watched Coon too.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we gotta do the Dune Coon 2, the Coon and
the reduning, yeah. okay. Yeah, we can't do it in this episode right now because we have content. Yeah. I do want to give like you're gonna love this because I know you've talked about you enjoyed the film. I watched, of course, a rip of it with friends, and. So I just got like the first rip that had it said like English audio and then English. It didn't. I didn't look for like the subs. The subs would matter. I assume they'd be hard coded or soft coded as like the subs. This movie is Dune 2. The subs are very important because there's a lot of like talk in local.
There's Fremen and then there's the unintelligible Harkonnen.
Yes, Battle Cant, which I'm a big fan of in Dune. I'm a big fan.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
The concept.
There's this weird thing on Twitter now where there's a lot of movie content, or at least I mean that's what like the algorithm is pushing. I don't quite know why, but anyway, there was somebody I didn't follow.
We're kind of brag. My algorithm is better or worse. I am getting homosexuals critiquing the excesses of homosexuality in America. That's my current.
Yeah, movies. That's funny. Yeah, I don't know which is that's funny. I don't know which is gayer actually. But anyway, yeah, so there was a thread that I did agree. I mean, it was, one of these like movie critics on Twitter, because I guess that's a thing. But he made a point that I totally agree with, which is that the directorially the most interesting and really the only artistically like cool design decision was the sequence with, I should save it for the actual thing, but with the sequence with Faye Rauta on the arena.
Yeah, that was good. But I wasn't. So my joke was my joke was something that happened to me because I'm a fucking idiot. But also perhaps maybe enjoyed the film more as a result. Did not have any subs for any of the non-English dialogue at all. Just no. And I assumed it was just a choice.
Oh, like, well, that like, would like, cool. That's the kind of thing that like the would have made the movie better actually.
Yeah, like I don't speak like I am. Well, I guess presumably it got when it was before Paul starts talking a lot. I realized it like halfway through. I was like, "Oh, this is fine." Actually, I don't care. But because it is a visual film, it's much more visual than it is like it's the first one, even for sure. Yes, it's a visual spectacle. So I assumed it was a choice, and like Paul didn't speak Fremen yet, and I was like, "Oh, they're doing like the thing, right?" You have to like kind of into it via the tone, intonation, and what they're doing and saying and looking at like. Through context to understand what they're saying because you don't speak the language yet, right? Because Paul didn't speak it yet in the beginning. It's like, oh, okay, that's actually very cool. Like, I'm totally down with that. And then I realized, like, when they're like talking to the Emperor and or making like bold declarations of war plan councils, like, ah, oh, fuck, I'm an idiot. Like, there's a file I didn't attach to the thing. God damn it. But I still enjoyed it immensely. And I want, this is the second time me and the same group of friends have done this, because we steal movies. We don't purchase movies from, you know, the Jews. We watched the first 25 minutes. No, maybe 15 minutes of John Wick 4 without the, so we, it was a, this was a great, it's a great piracy moment without the, so like it, the, we got somehow the background dial, background audio only, and not like the dialogue file or whatever. Or, so there was no like human speech, but like all the background noise and like gunshots and stuff. And we assumed that was just, like, because John Wick, it's a fucking gunshots movie, right? So we assumed it was, like, very, very muted talking and, like, loud background and gunshots. We're like, oh, this is a cool choice. They're really doing a thing here. And no, we just fucked up. And didn't have the, like, the I guess, I don't know how, first audio or primary audio, I don't know, one of the one that you would replace in the dub, in dubbing with a, you know, English or whatever language, we did, just didn't have that attached. It was very fun. So yeah, because once again, it was like, oh, they're doing a thing here. Like the talking is not as important, like, as the action, which is like in John Wick movies. Like, once again, we could have pushed through that. We did push through June because there was enough English and whatever. The other thing was, my friend had watched it prior in the theater, and it had, he, we live in multicultural America, right? He had watched it with, somehow, he was at a movie theater of, like, Spanish people, because that's just, like, the world we live in, and, I say Spanish, Mexicans, and, so the subtitles they were using for that, for those same scenes were in...
The term is beaners, but anyway, sorry, go on.
Yes, we're all in Spanish, so when the firm would talk, it would be, like, in Spanish subs, but he, like, speaks enough to, like, get that, you know, he speaks, yeah. And he was like, oh, no, they're subs, but they're, like, they're in Spanish. I was like, wait, there's no way. What do you mean they're subs, but they're in Spanish? Oh. So there was a lot of realizations there that night. It was a fun time. I enjoyed that immensely. And I could also ask him occasionally for, like, what the fuck is going on here? What do you remember from your Spanish run of this film? That's for your new game plus. But, yeah, so we've had some fun. I played some more games, but... I don't want to just, like, bore the audience with, like, I played a game for 5 minutes. It's bad.
Yeah, we'll have plenty more video game content. Hopefully some Elden Ring DLC content. Premium Elden Ring content next time. Meanwhile, do you want to talk Israel first or Ukraine first?
Well, I think the most exciting stuff is Ukraine, because I have a new, like, Ukraine source. Well, a couple of new Ukraine sources, actually. I've developed...
As a respected geopolitical analyst on the world stage, you have your own stable of sources, of course.
Yeah. So have you ever? So I was deep diving into the manpower pool, right? The narrative is that, like, casualties are so bad that Ukraine may break, right? Just by pure, like, they can't recover losses. Okay,
we'll get into it in a second. Go on. That is a narrative.
Yes. I was looking, like, how deep is the manpower pool was a question, and like, and it's hard to understand, and like, also I have certain assumptions that we all have. It's like Ukraine is a weak state, like the state apparatus is weak, and I was like, what the fuck does that actually mean, like, in practice? Because, like, I live in America with in a major city, and the state is weak here, right? But, like, I have no doubt they could draft everybody here, like, you know, like, I was like, so I've been deep diving in a lot of my presuppositions. I also a company also did, like, a Mediazona treatment to Ukrainian casualties, and if you're from Mediazona, it's the BBC and I want to say Estonia, one of the butthurt belt countries, one of their media, actually Estonia, probably Latvia, because it's the most linguistic similar to Russian, it doesn't matter, where they collate Russian casualties via obituaries and Facebook or VK posts. And, like, to actually find
Arizona, I know that. I don't know if you're talking about them, but yeah.
I mean, I've heard the thing. Yeah, so it's a Russian losses count, there allegedly has the same thing has been done to Ukraine now, and the numbers are actually very similar. So I was considering, oh, maybe like, and you know, it's hard that it's Ukraine is more it's much more black boxing their losses, obviously. So like maybe, but the losses were actually pretty like one for one, which is actually unsurprising for about. Wars losses are generally in combat, one to one, massive, much like in the rout. In the ancient world, you see most of the losses. In actual like direct combat, losses are generally one to one. All technology being equal, right? Tactics and technology beyond a certain point don't actually shift that too much. So I was thinking, okay, well, I really think the Ukrainians don't really show signs of breaking. And I was looking at the manpower pool, and that's where I found this new source. And
I want to clarify. You say you don't see signs of the Ukrainians breaking?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was looking, so that's where I found this new source in Ukraine. And I gotta say, it is very. I'm not like hiding my sources. I'll tell you what it is after this. But I also don't want to like crush this guy with people and stuff. And also don't want to like get him in a lot of trouble somehow, but it is you could
yeah,
if you know
please absolutely anonymize.
If you know, you know, this is a person who is a journalist in Ukraine, who is a American citizen despite being of like 100% Ukrainian descent and ethnicity, who is a bit of a leftist, and is like was a Zelensky critic before. This is gonna. If you know who this is, you're gonna know who this is. This person's family are like high up Zelenskyites, like in the elite, and he is basically a commie, pretty much, and has been like disowned by them for his like critical reporting. He's not draftable or like fuckwithable because of his American citizenship. So he's got some very.
I mean, it sounds like he has particularly protected status, whoever this person is, and I am a little concerned now for his well-being. But the American embassy put out a circular. The American embassy in Ukraine put out a letter saying that dual American citizens.
He is not dual.
Okay. Oh, all right.
He
well,
is,
there you go.
Born in America.
Not permitted to leave the country. Like essentially, if you have Ukrainian citizenship, even if you have an American passport, you may not leave Ukraine.
Yes. This person is like an open. This is his project. Okay, this person is openly a journalist, like in there. Like it's not like a source in the sense of like someone who is secret telling me these things. There's no risk like that. There's no new information being gleaned here. Like he's got Substack. If you know who it is, you know who it is. But he was talking about this is very interesting. There are a lot of people in Ukraine who aren't being drafted. And you basically just don't leave your house. If you don't, it's literally like a horror movie. If you don't leave your house, they can't get you. The current status of the like press gang police is that they don't have the right to. They need a warrant to go into your house. And Ukraine is very shitty about like, you know, your processes. And there's so many people. It's easier just to, like, you know. Hang out by the supermarket and try to grab people. So people just don't leave. Men in draft range just don't leave their houses. And this is creating a lot of interesting tensions in Ukrainian society. But obviously you can't. So draft dodging has become like a national sport, obviously. But the biggest thing that was very interesting to me is that there is no. So people are dying when they get arrested by the draft police. They'll get beaten. Beaten bloody, they'll be killed sometimes, very commonly. They'll just die in like custody. They'll say they had an epileptic event, or they were died of alcoholism suddenly. These are like the ways they label these deaths. But
they were vaxxed.
Yes, the vaxxed. So the people have gotten like, why is this? Like, okay, well these people are fucking sociopaths. They will fucking beat you to death. They will murder you. What's the next step? How do we come back from here, right? Like I said, they can't go into your house. So if you do get picked up, and people do get picked up a lot, it happens, right? You can't really avoid, like, that sometimes you have to leave your house to get, like, food and stuff. And maybe you can send your family members, maybe you don't have family members, maybe whatever reason to leave your house. The current meta for Ukraine draft dodging is you get drafted, that you get grabbed, right? You just, as soon as they get hands on you, you go quietly, right? Trying to resist at the point of attention is very, it's, there's videos of it, obviously, of it happening, but it's very sketchy and, like, is dangerous. What you do is, you get mobilized, you get in processed into the Ukrainian military. And they, once you begin your, like, training, as soon as they give you your gun, the next time from when you've been issued up until when you get moved or move, like you transport to the next location in Ukraine, then you desert and return to your house. Ideally with your gun, usually not, because you gotta drop your shit in, like, Pennsylvania clothes and find your way back home. Because, you know, you have a gun.
Well, I guess I don't know for sure, but there are reports that I believe that new recruits, fresh mobilized are now being blindfolded as they're transported to the front, because the ones who don't do that and who do actually end up having to take up positions are surrendering at such a frequent rate and causing, like, intelligence problems because they're just giving up information because they don't give a shit, that the new Ukrainian command meta is to blindfold them on the way. Now, again, that could just be Russian rumor, but certainly truthy.
Well, that, I think you just find out where you are, like, look at a fucking street sign, you know? Yeah, we're in, blah, 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 yep, you know, it's like, maybe.
Yeah.
The Russians are pushing this big. They had that kid who stole a T-64 and, like, gave it to the Russians as he deserted. He's right. They're, you know, big deal of him. But so you desert at this point, and it's very hard for them to recapture you, right? Because what are they gonna fucking do, right? Let's say they get you,
yeah,
put you in the fucking army, and then you do it again, right? Like, so yeah. It's like, don't resist. It's like what they've been trying to tell blacks to do with the cops. Like, don't resist them when they arrest you, you dumbass. They're gonna drop all the charges. Like, it's like.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very similar to, like, American policing of African criminals in that respect.
So
there's all these laws that the Ukrainians are adopting to try to fix this. And one of them is in the Soviet type systems, there are, like, informal hierarchies of bureaucracies. Like, bureaucracies will outrank another one. And one of the big rankings that's very controversial somewhat is that, like, so the highest ranking bureaucracy is intelligence, right? The actual, like, you know, KGB, right? That's, like, clearly the highest of all. Whatever. There's some weird ones, like the miners' union in the Soviet Union outranked, like, some wild stuff. Like, you wouldn't, like, Department of the Interior or whatever. I think, the miners have, like, a special carve out. It's very arcane. But one of the biggest and most important ones is that the military outranks the civilian police. You saw this in Russia recently, where the FSB, the KGB, was the ones who arrested a bunch of military officers on corruption charges related to the war with, like, you know, just overspending for things and things going missing. Because you imagine, oh, the civil police do that, but the civil police are a lower ranking bureaucracy than the military. So the higher ranking bureaucracy has to actually do the arrests, no matter who did the investigation. So this what happens in Ukraine is they want to create a military police force, not military police, like the job, the military, that exists, but a police force that is nominally part of the military.
Policing unit that is.
So it outranks, yes, it would outrank civilian police, because in Ukraine, the catchers of, you know, draft dodgers are, it's the civilian government, right? There's the department or whatever, you know, census and whatever, I don't know how exactly what the breakdown is, but, It's civilian police, effectively, and, like, volunteers too. It's a very weird, like, volunteer structure of these catchers as well, where they, like, don't get paid, but they do get paid by oligarchs who are pro-Ukrainian, to assist. Anyway, these guys are can't go in your house. This military police function, because like it's a military martial law thing, will be able to enter your house. And the pitch is that, oh, it's to find deserters. Like, deserters are the ones this force will go after. But it's very clear that if this force is established, its job will be just to go into your... Because, like, imagine a commie block, right? If there's a guy hiding in every room in the commie block, you can mobilize 100 guys if you just open every door in the commie block, right? So that's a thing that's very much like on the mind. They have adopted a... It's fuzzy to find out what has gone through and what's in the RADA, the parliament, but they are considering just scrapping all existing exemptions and like making people reapply for all their draft dodge, you know, medical or whatever. And the other thing is that they're going to, for basically a little over a month's wages for an average Ukrainian, which is very low, create a straight like draft dodger tax. Like, okay, you just can pay this money to not get drafted. It's out the reach of so many people that it wouldn't affect. It would be quote unquote like good and work because it basically just formalized.
You don't pay it, are you in jail? Like,
well, they're from, but it basically would just formalize the existing system, make the government make money instead of like corrupt doctors and draft officials. It's basically, it's pretty open. Like, sure. Okay, there's
I mean that all. I mean. I don't know. I get what you're saying, and I do. It's a common refrain from the NAFO side of things that like when people start pointing out, I don't know about one to one. I mean, I guess it would depend on the front. And like for example, Bob Chance currently, I can easily believe that's pretty much one to one in certain other very hot areas of the front. But in general, I think the real number is much closer to like 1 to 7. At a kind of, I would say that's a low ball. And there's good quantitative reason to think that if you compare like Midia-Zona, I believe, I don't know if it's Latvia or who exactly, but it's basically if you, it's not 100% complete, but if you are a Russian and you are KIA and there is any mention of it anywhere on Russian social media, if your mom posts on VK, your Russian Facebook, or if there's a news article in your hometown newspaper, or if any kind of mention anywhere at all that's like fully, you know, OSINTable, you will go into that statistic. And the overwhelming majority of Russian KIAs are in that statistic. And the I think it's like up to 60,000 or so now, which is a lot. Don't get me wrong. That is pretty bad. But it's, I mean, I think reliable estimates of Ukraine is, you know, not quite 10 times that, but somewhere between 7 and 10 times that approximately for like total figures. And now again, so then when this conversation starts happening, as kind of grim and horrible as it is, that's when the NAFO types will say, well, there's still millions of draftable men in Ukraine that haven't emigrated yet. Why don't they have all these people? It's really quite disgusting. I'm not gonna like pretend that I understand the mentality of like who is it? Jihadi Julian, like Julian Rupka. It's one of these type. I mean, he's German, shit lib, Gunther type. Basically, he's like Gunther, but a journalist instead of whatever the fuck Gunther is. And like how are you a German journalist and you're like, there's all these millions of men who haven't been shipped off to the front yet. Like, what the fuck are you doing, Ukraine? Like, And you see that a lot. You see that's basically like the NAFO party line. And I'm sure there's a lot of truth to it, but I'm also equally certain that number one, like the Ukraine is already running on fumes economically. Like they just simply don't have the...
Can I go into one of my sources?
Yeah, please, absolutely.
So I was looking at like, okay, what does barrel scraping look like? Scraping the barrel, right, for manpower. So there are, do you remember the pre-war, they were talking about like Azov Battalion has all these like camps for young people, like to train them into being Nazis?
So I was, guys, like, were invited. I don't know if people went or not, but yeah.
Yeah. So these camps have been kind of formalized into like a nationalist training version of the British system where the kids would be kind of sent to the countryside, you know? During the World War II, look with the bombings, you to live in a farm or whatever, like a Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe type stuff during the Blitz. But like also there's like a level of training and ideological kind of, Ukrainian nationalism attached to it. So they've gotten quite large. And also Ukraine has like intentionally kept the draft age high at 25, and they've been lowering it maybe to 24.
Right.
They're still,
Yes.
which
Oh,
is a
they I
pool.
lowered from 27 to 25. I don't know that they I didn't hear about lowering it to 24.
Yes. But or some, like, they're doing things in the margins. So there is still, of course, that pool of under 25s, which has not been accessed. Volunteers have gone, obviously. And the Russians are reporting rumors incorrectly that you can be drafted from 17 to 25 now or mobilized. It's a very like autistic exception that applied to no one, where if you were a military reservist, they could mobilize you. It's like, yeah, no shit, like you're a military reservist. Like that was a. So there were like some 22-year-old guy who was a reservist before the war and got drafted against his will and died. And like, oh, but like, yeah, but he was like in the military reserves. Like that's gonna happen. Not like they're just. So, but these camps currently have a manpower and women power of about 72,000. So these people who are
Yeah,
above the
sorry,
age
real quick on the women thing. Like, I saw women like videos of women like being women and screaming and crying. They're like, I'm in a basement getting shelled. Like, what the fuck? And I'll have to be like, yeah, what the
of
fuck?
yeah, those are
Sorry, get
volunteers.
out.
Oh, that's the wild thing. Those are volunteers. These camps for kids, like nationalists, whatever's, they have a current just sitting manpower pool right now of 72,000, which is a lot. And I cannot imagine a situation in which
Okay,
they
I mean
are
that's not nothing. I don't
that
know if I'd say that's a
desperate,
lot.
they're that as for manpower,
That they
that
wouldn't be tapping.
they wouldn't be tapping. These are like Azov kids, right? Like, yes, they're like, 13 to 17 or whatever, but like, that's, I mean, come on, so the government in Ukraine is not touching certain pools for later or for like ethical reasons. Like also when this war ends, they want to have people, right? Like, who are in all age brackets.
I don't get that sense at all. I mean, it's possible, but that is
I
not
mean,
the sense.
they wouldn't keep the age at 25 if they were being like utterly retarded.
I mean, look, I could be wrong. The sense that I get, which of course, I mean, I have my biases and my priors, and in general, we've been on, I wouldn't say opposite sides of this, just you've been more skeptical and I've been more credulous about the pro-Russian slant. I just don't think, I don't think they have, number one, the economic capability to, like, I think you're identifying something correct, which is in general, there are warm bodies still available. And number two, if they really, really, if manpower were such an acute crisis that it was, do or die, then they would do, right? That's probably true. And I don't think that's to that point. I don't agree with your assessment that, I don't think they get, I don't think they're, I think they're huffing unicorn farts. They're thinking about the end of the war, or I have seen no indication whatsoever that there's anything remotely like a realistic assessment of. I mean, if they're capable of a realistic assessment, it's just they would have. They wouldn't have. Zelensky would still be in charge, and they'd be fighting, a brutal attritional withdrawal every inch of the way, but not, but in a smart way instead of just launching counterattacks for PR and upcoming from Redditors. So no, I just think this is a delusion. I think this is like a this is like the kind of Slavic meathead wing of the same extent, like the same kind of retarded delusion that you see in the American White House. That's a kind of more like urban shit lib flavor of delusion instead of like Slavic meathead pounding vodka and potatoes kind of vibe. But it's very much the same level of disconnect from reality. And more to the point, yeah, I was saying, I don't think they can handle like, the Ukrainian economy, such as it is entirely financed by the American government. They cannot pay their debts. They are the there there's I haven't I saw it come up, I guess, I presume, I don't know if it's either about to hit or the story quietly went away right before there was a deadline of interest payments on just one tranche of $20 billion in private loans that had been extended to the Ukrainian government, essentially at the behest of Zog, going around to, like, you know, billionaires and oil oligarchs and whatever around the world and saying, hey, you know, chip in, and it's a loan, so you'll get paid back. And they're like, okay, well, they're not going to get, the question is, how much of a haircut are they going to take? Now, that's a haircut, as I understand it, on privately issued debt from billionaires, but they're not any more able to pay public debt to European governments or the American government or anything like this. Just not, there's no money, and there's not going to be any money because there's no economy. And to the extent there is any kind of an economy, it's like this, there, the thing about scraping the barrel, like to use the hearts of iron metaphor, is like, yeah, you, there are military benefits, of course, and you can do it for a while, but at a certain point, which there, I think we are probably just past the tipping point, you cannot, like the bodies that you put on the front or in training are bodies that are not like, you know, running cash registers at a grocery store or whatever, or making drones in an underground factory. So they're at the point, I think, where they're, it's not so much of like that. I think the thing about lowering the draft age, it's yes, there's probably something to it, of because there are conservatively a couple, 4 million or so, I would say, is my sense of like draftable bodies, which is a lot. That is on paper a lot, but it's economically impossible and politically impossible. There's no, like, the even just getting this, the lowering of the draft age from 27 to 25 was, it's like the RADA, their parliament had to, like, the parliament members were essentially in hiding from the populace. Like, they couldn't, and I believe in the final event, it was essentially, like, it was an official act of the Ukrainian parliament, but it was essentially some kind of irregular procedure or something where essentially it was just the president making a decree functionally that the RADA was able to absolve themselves of responsibility in some kind of Talmudic way. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been wrong before about
the way I see it is there are two, like, they have at least minimum two, like, manpower reserves they can tap that would massively change the amount of extra manpower that they aren't doing right now and aren't really even pushing to do, which would be, like, these new, like, I don't know, nationalist Hitler Youth Battalions, whatever you want to call them, you know, and below the 18 to 25 year olds. Like, these are both two big pools.
Well, I mean, but the other, well, okay, 72,000, I would just not say that's not a big pool. I mean, it is, like, that's what?
It's a very big pool in terms of, like, that would be months of growth. Like, the way armies grow, yeah, it's like, that's like 2 to 6 months of army growth and replenishment.
Okay, so maybe then it's just we're interpreting that. I agree. To me, that's like just not much. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's just not, again, total aside, but I'm going to feel like, you feel me? You see this guy? The guy who shot Julio Fulio recorded a video of himself. You feel me?
Yeah, yeah. Only 10 grand to kill Julio Fulio, too, apparently. So, it's a bargain.
Yeah. Anyway, you feel me? I mean, I just don't think, like, yeah, that's 2 to 6 months of urban defense. Yeah, sure, that'll buy that. I just don't see that as being all that substantive.
I think that's a lot. Not decisive, but, like, it's a good bit. But
well, is it going to change the outcome? And is it going to, like, I mean, what's going to happen in the interim in those 6 months elsewhere on the front geopolitically in terms of the supply? Like, is American manufacturing going to be able to start making air defense missiles more efficiently and faster? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, leaving aside, we haven't even gotten into it. It's not even really, I mean, who cares? And it's not in our purview, but, like, all this hilarity that's ensuing with Biden and Kamala, it's like, I mean, there's no, the United States itself is in steep structural decline and has intractable, I mean, this is real collapsing empire hours. On the American, leaving aside the Ukrainian proxy war stuff.
Yeah. So speaking of collapsing things, do you want me to go into what a weak state looks like in Ukraine? Like what that actually means in practice?
Yeah.
So give me like what you think that means, because there's a lot of like, it's kind of an assumption, and I kind of want to look at like what people say, oh, the Ukrainian state is weak.
I wouldn't actually, I don't know that I would make that assumption, I guess, first of all. I mean, it would depend on what you meant by weak. I the way I sort of have Ukraine filed is a kind of corrupt military junta kleptocracy that if you have a certain threshold of money, you can kind of do whatever, but if you don't, you're essentially at the mercy of government goons. I don't know if that makes the state weak or not.
So good news for you. Good news. There's not that many government goons in Ukraine. Kind of. There's a lot of goons on paper, but it resembles Afghanistan in this manner, where there's like a lot of paper police officers, but not that many actually police officers. Yeah. That's a very pretty much side point. So pre-war, obviously, the Ukrainian state, like the free, you know, the new country of Ukraine, very much changed its focus from, and actually only accelerated as time went on. In the post-Soviet period, the easy way to say it is like, imagine if the 90s never ended in Russia. Like it was just the 90s forever. Which is true, but like, what does that look like in practice? Like, okay, so they like, things are privatized, billionaires own every single thing, but like, what would that mean for the ideology of Russia? Right, Russia couldn't stomach this, right? So they elected Vladimir Putin to end privatization and reverse it in a lot of ways, and like restore kind of a national dignity and like a centralized state bureaucracy that has a level of authority and power, despite not being like ideological communists, right? They're now they're just like Russian nationalists or whatever. In Ukraine, they didn't do this. There was no Putin figure. There's very contentious elections and these things. But this created a kind of a state ideology that can only be described as like libertarian, where the Ukrainian state, like things like pensions, which is a big deal in Eastern Europe, I mean in the world, Social Security, it's a big deal, right? But like, these things were never really increased with inflation, including keeping pace. Like, it's down to like $100 a month, basically, if you're a pensioner. Barely have to live on, right? The state would not, basically, the state won't give you shit, is the Ukrainian model, right? But the corollary of this is that people don't expect shit from the state. So they have to, you know, develop these kind of more like communal networks of people and getting access to things. There's no, and like reporting to the state that you even like, other than like maybe like the birth of a child or a driver's license, you're not really interacting with the state much at all. It became a bit of a, how do you say? So people would like just had a lot of jobs just for cash. Very common in Ukraine not to pay taxes, right? You just all under the table because people just like didn't see.
Pride in kleptocracy, absolutely.
Yeah, there's no duty, but this is like low. This is at the low level of things. Like this is like your average day laborer or guys working on a farm, as seasonal farm labor, and also costs are low too. So like you could make enough money to just get by. You work a few months out of the year as an itinerant farm laborer. You live with your parents in their formerly Soviet commie block apartment. But you have very low costs. And then you eventually get married to a girl in a similar situation. And it was like not a big deal much. Like it was like, oh, fine. Like, the government just doesn't do much for us. And we don't do anything for the government either. And this was like, everyone's okay with this. Like, okay, like they privatized the healthcare system, they privatized, or elements of it. They privatized this. Pensions are always constantly getting cut. They're getting cut again during the war. The government was always considered corrupt. The police are just like shakedown artists, right? which creates a actually not a terrible place for a lot of things. Like there was a there's like a kind of a two economies. There's like a above ground economy and a below ground economy. The above ground economy where like you pay taxes. If you're like a Western company coming to invest, you would be like, you know, tracked and, you know, have employees and stuff who would pay taxes. But if you didn't, like you didn't, it was not a big deal culturally. Kind of a, you know, it was like a, how Germans imagine Greece to be, if that makes sense. Like everyone's dodging taxes
But it's just generic. I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's like Eastern European. It's just tried and true. It's just Eastern Europe, man.
Like, yeah. But the problem comes about when you get to this idea of, oh, well, they are a sovereign government. They can, like, draft people, right? And to draft people, you need to have, like, legitimacy. And it's like, the government needs to provide for you at some base level that, like, oh, this is a kind of a, if not an equal exchange of, like, your life for the state, it, like, makes a certain amount of, like, sense. And in Ukraine, it, like, just doesn't. There's all kind of, like, words and phrases for what they call it. They're all in Ukraine. I'm not going to repeat them because I'm going to just butcher them. But Ukraine has its nationalists, and those seem to tide it over for the first, like, 6 months to a year of the war, of, like, volunteers who hated Russia, had some kind of esoteric political ideology. And this kind of covered up a multitude of sins, right? Where these people were willing to fight and volunteer, and even though like, even though they were mobilizing, it wasn't super hard, and they couldn't really get people. But they've created this system now. Those people are basically tapped out. There are not, outside of like actual like the children of like nationalist political elites, or they call they have a phrase for it in Ukraine. They call like national liberalism, which is very funny. I believe it's tongue in cheek, like national socialism, but liberalism. Outside of like their direct kids, there's not, which are now it's to some degree even getting, if not drafted, like socially.
I don't know what else, because I guess I should. I think it would be funny, but apparently they have just a totally, basically like a flat Earth tier historiography of like we was the real Aryans and all just complete insane shit as far as the so-called history of Ukraine as part of their, is like this legally mandated in their like high school history textbook.
Yeah. But like, are they like, is it, that's true. But like, I think they're probably still using
it.
I think they're still using the textbooks from the Soviet Union in school. Cause like you can mandate that, but like
the school can't buy them. I'm sure they had all kinds of insane shit in the Soviet Union too, but that's all.
No, I'm saying they have this stuff, but they can't buy it. Like a school, a public school in Ukraine is not going to be like purchasing the new textbooks. It's just not, functionally, yeah. Like
it sounds like the state is not going to be giving it to them from what you're saying.
Yeah, right? You know what I'm saying. Like, so like, oh yeah, I'm sure there's like the official book of, you know, Ukrainian, you know, linguistics and anthropology, but like who's actually like being taught that outside of like big universities in Kiev is like. So there's a system of like under conditions of like libertarianism, no one's joining up, and like they don't feel the duty to it. And the problem is to address this, they have the police became like the police are acting, you know, when governments need to do things, they have the police force, the military, right? So their estimates as high as there's 1 million cops in Ukraine now. The police forces are the only job in Ukraine of all the government's jobs that have been given 100% draft exemption status for their employees. So the way it works is, like I said, there is the above-ground economies, right? Like government jobs, it's an above-ground economy. They're going to tax your wages. You're a Western company. You're a company of large enough scale. You can't, like, hide your stuff, right? So based on – so every company and government bureaucracy and whatever civil – any organization that has, like, paid employees – because this was the only way the government could like find people, was given based on what they do a certain rating of like a percentage basis, right? And they were given, so you have 100 employees, I rate your company as 45% important to the government, to the economy, you can pass out 45 exemptions to your employees of your 100 employees, right? Which makes sense. That's how I make like, oh, we're gonna, you know, distribute impact here. Oh, you get some weird stuff with, like, who do you give those to of your employees, you know? But that's kind of your choice to make as the employer. But the police got a bunch, got 100%, were the only, I believe, the except outside of like high government jobs, like government department of culture, as an example, only got 40%. So like some of these bullshit departments of government aren't actually getting that. IT workers, the famous like only people who bring in hard currency. Well, IT workers and agricultural workers were people who brought in hard currency into Ukraine, because like in the same way Pajits in India can be your manpower for your IT product. Ukrainians could also do that for cheap, not as cheap as Indians and at a much higher degree of capability. But you could like off outsource to these firms in Ukraine. They're getting hit pretty hard now, just because the government knows they exist, right? If you're an employee, the government knows you exist. They just got your ass to a large degree, and the police get 100%. So a lot of people join, like become cops or cops on paper. And the other manpower pool that I want to talk about as a third manpower pool, I don't think it's 1 million guys. I won't prefer that. Is the police? There is a big movement to like draft the cops now. It's like, well, the cops don't have to go, and they're grabbing us. This is a actual legitimacy crisis in Ukraine, inside Ukraine. One of two ongoing ones where, like, the police forces are, historically not a great relationship with the people, but in like the Soviet Union, it was like actually not a big deal. Like, they're cops, like, whatever, you just don't break the law. You can pay them off or whatever. But the bribe threshold is rising. These cops are constantly being exposed. A lot of cops were lying about being like, oh, I went to the front for such time during whatever. And there were a couple of there are not a lot, a few battalions of like. They have a Polizei, I believe. It's German, though. There's a word. They've built a couple battalions of like ex-cop, like volunteers who were cops, and they were really pushing around. Oh, the cops are, they're fighting too, But everyone knows like what percentage your job has because it's like public information. So the cops are really, really hated, and this is creating an actual crisis inside Ukraine where like hostility is becoming very, very open with the cops, and. As the police become more and more important with this draft stuff, which is also the reason to have that those military police who will have a fresh reputation to some degree as like not the corrupt shitty cops that are, oh, there's a new patriotic thing there. So there's that crisis, which is pairing interestingly with another crisis, which you will enjoy. So the Ukrainians are national liberalism is like the state ideology, but they're Eastern Europeans, so they don't have a lot of the hang-ups that other people have, like race and religion and Judaism, frankly. So they have a term which I translated directly is called Sorosite, like George Soros. And the two factions of like the Ukrainian government right now are the Zelenskyites and the Sorosite. Well, and the nationalists. So three big Azov guys, right? Azov guys are still a faction. Azovites, Sorosites, and Zelenskyites. And Sorosites are the Western NGO complex that pre-war was about like corruption minimalization, which really meant like corruption for the West interests. Universities, the West
Yeah,
set up a bunch of.
that's where like the Trump and Hunter Biden stuff came out of, was that whole scene.
Yes, like investigations by those guys that were like they didn't put the kibosh on fast enough, and like that came like the kernel of it. And yes, so university professors who aren't nationalists, and like the Zelensky clique is a very different crew than these people. These people have been around since before
Fucking potato
Euromaidan.
people.
Yeah, they're not very popular, right? But they are like they control the media in
It's
Ukraine,
interesting. Well,
right?
it's interesting because maybe you probably know more about this than I do, but from what I can tell, like the fact that Zelensky's Jewish is kind of like he's almost functionally not. I mean, even
He's
despite
yeah
what
he's
he
he's not he's in the non-Jewish faction. Like, this is the Jew faction
yeah.
driving George Shiri. And he's not
Yeah.
Zelensky is very pointedly like, not in it. And this is creating a tension because the recently in the past few months, Zaluzhny was maybe the genesis of this, but like not quite really. She kind of think I think it's kind of a happy accident. The
By the way,
Sorosites
can you
are
imagine? I feel like good and bad for. I mean, like, you know, Zaluzhny deserves to chill in a nice apartment in London. You know, like, well done, sir.
Yeah. So the thing is, yeah, Zaluzhny, I think, is not actually going to like run against Zelensky. Like, that's a pipe dream that the Russians keep floating. But so there's this situation where post Zaluzhny, the Sorosites basically dropped their ban. So before the war started, they fucking hated Zelensky. Zelensky was willing. He was a avowed liberal who was trying to make overtures to Azov, who was a Russia shill. All these things that they considered him. He wanted to do Minsk II for real, you know, to stop the war. These are like pre-war Zelensky is very different than the current war Zelensky. When the war starts, Zelensky is kind of
ran on like we're gonna play nice with not we're gonna reorient towards Russia, but we're gonna play nice and we're gonna gonna
peace in our time, right? Yeah. So war starts and Zelensky becomes like Zelensky the character, right? The paladin of Ukraine or whatever the fuck you want to call him
with the green with the olive drab.
Yes, yeah. He's no longer like tool of the oligarchs. So like this is the former like oligarch faction, by the way. Like the Zelensky was the media and the oligarch faction versus like the Western backed faction that he defeated in his elections. There has been a moratorium on Zelensky criticism in the Ukrainian media from like the big organs, which are owned by the Sorosite faction. They have stopped it's on. The last 3 months, they've been like really hitting him, pretty viciously. Incompetence, corruption, his kids the kids of his political class not being drafted is becoming a bigger deal. Stories of these guys going to Austria and, you know, on like, oh, I have a medical illness that only a clinic in Austria knows how to treat, these kind of things. Like the children of these elites going there, very big deal. Zelensky has like counterpunched, or the Zelensky faction has counterpunched by mobilizing a lot of these people, sending them to go die in the war if they can. They have the corruption offices, like the corruption investigators, had their percentage. So that like percentages matter because they've reduced the percentage of people that these government branches and offices can reserve from the draft. So they're absolutely gutting them.
Because they are having a manpower crisis. Like not actually, like crisis is the right word.
This is gulag. This is gulag. This is not bad. This is gulag. This is like the equivalent of gulagging somebody. Like in the Soviet Union, they would send you to a mental institution or gulag. In Ukraine, they send you to the front to die. Yeah, it's been sent to the Eastern Front in Germany. Like they're murdering these guys by sending them to the front. Like these are not the manpower. These are like these offices are like 100 people, right? And like they're not. This is not a manpower crisis issue. This is they're murdering these niggers. This is murder. This is not tactical.
Yeah,
this is a much older school, you know, Eastern Bloc stuff. And of course, both sides of this clique, both the Zelenskyites and the fucking Sorosites, they were all cheating the system, right? Like they were all doing like all that. None of their kids were going to fight and die, right? Obviously.
It was the the $1 million, not the Hunter Biden dick pic post, but those millions of dollars that were going to Hunter Biden were coming from the Soros people, like the Western-backed liberal faction.
It was actually the other one. It was the oligarchs. It was the Sorosites who blew open the story as a corruption story and then fucking nixed it. They created the story. Hunter Biden is a Zelenskyite in this paradigm.
The oligarch guys like to stay in the
Austria apparently. So this has created a situation where the both sides are going to art trash. So the Zelensky's they have their own media. Social media is a big weapon because like you'll see a lot of things on like social media now or like government owned media attacking the the Sorosites for, oh, look, all their kids went to Austria too. You know, like, look at this, look at that. So both sides are basically savaging each other for draft dodging, which is the current like big charge in Ukraine. It's always like you're a draft dodger, your kid's a draft dodger, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody's draft dodging, you know, so whatever. So, but this is big because this is probably the one thing that could. So, like I said, the Sorosite factions are a proxy for the West, right? Like, they're not that independent. They're Jews, a lot of them too, right? So, like, you can view that, you can extrapolate this into a loss of confidence in the person of Zelensky, from the West, and I think that's a bit more of a, it's a bit of a jump, but I think that Zelensky replacement or castration may be in the process. Also, Zelensky has like kind of freaked out and fired some people who were thought to be loyalists.
Yes, there's been a lot of shakeup in the particularly military brass, but I don't
yes,
know, like the civil sector. But it wouldn't surprise me if it's just, it hadn't crossed my desk. But definitely
yeah.
the like
and a lot of shakeup. Yeah, a lot of the Zelensky faction people are like political shapeshifters, because like Zelensky was like Macron, he kind of came out of nowhere and won. So a lot of people like kind of just declared for him in the election that were not historically like whatever the fuck ideology he is. Like, they're just like political opportunists doing political opportunism, which is weird though, because like those people are not getting fucked with. It's like generals and stuff. Like, I guess those who have a certain amount of loyalty because they're kind of bought in. But Zelensky has always been somewhat paranoid of his structure because they're not. No one's ideology, like national liberalism, is not an ideology. Well, it's not the actual name of whatever they call it, but it's not actually like an ideology. It's just like the person of Zelensky and the oligarchs. And Zelensky, in the early phase of the war, managed to like somewhat, with the help of the Sorosites as his like alternate power base, did castrate a lot of the oligarchs in a kind of a Putinist manner, which was the right thing for the war. Right, you don't want your war effort run by a bunch of fucking oligarchs. But the problem is in 2014, the oligarchs ran the war in 2014. The war in 2014 was a oligarch pet project, basically. So you get into this weird thing where Zelensky doesn't really have a fallback base of power outside of the literal Azov battalion, and who want stuff from him, like they want tangible things from Zelensky. And then his like actual like pure political elite, he has like his own oligarchs, but they're not like the oligarch class writ large they used to be, because Zelensky like castrated a lot of them. A lot of them went to Israel for a reason, right? Like, he, both Putin and Zelensky used the war as a pretext to crack down on oligarchs they don't like, which means that oligarchs are just generally going to be more skittish about backing Zelensky because, you know, they think they're going to get a knife in the back over it. So that's a legitimacy crisis. There's a third crisis coming. Yeah, third crisis coming. Also, because I always mention two crises, the more crisis is that electoral power is fucked. Ukraine is now importing significant amounts of power from the European grid. They had not in for the beginning of the war. They the beginning of the war that was thought they would
yeah,
until
Russia
recently.
Very. I don't. I mean, again, one of these kind of. Well, I guess things take time or whatever. But they were namby-pamby about going after the grid for the first year and a half, and only very recently it started actually destroying significant electrical infrastructure.
Yes, the grid's been hit. The grid's been hit pretty hard. Actual power plants.
There's another thing, sort of. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to. Well, we'll get to that maybe later in terms of prognosis. But they've already done enough damage that it's going to be a very bad winter in Ukraine.
Estimates have ranged from 25% outage to 72% outage to 43% outage. I think the 43% outage is the current actual one, because it's from an actual like minister of the government of the interior, whatever position. The other two were a little more speculative, but they are currently doing whatever maintenance cycles they do on the remaining nuclear reactors. Because they can't do them in the winter, right? Because like they've realized like, okay, they're doing preventative maintenance on things they don't think the Russians will strike now, because they can't do the winter. But as a result of that, those nuclear reactors the Russians haven't hit yet or won't hit for whatever reason, because it's a fucking nuclear reactor. those going offline for this testing and evaluation or whatever the, I don't know the process of actually like nuclear reactor maintenance. That's already, there's already intermittent power in much of the country. There's been, what they mean by they say 40% power is kind of questionable too, like what these potential power is. But basically, it's brownouts have been basically announced. Like even during the winter, in the winter they've said, okay, during the coldest parts of the winter, you're going to get 4 to 8 hours of power. Has been what they're like preparing the public to accept, pretty openly. So,
have you ever lived in an environment where you had 4 hours of power a day? Because I have.
I've lived in zero and all. Okay. Actually, not too much intermittent.
All right. Yeah, because that's not fun.
Yeah. No. I imagine. There's also going to be this crisis where these without power, a lot of these commie blocks don't function. It's kind of the commie block is a very useful, like a lot of people. It's great for people who don't have houses, giving the houses right. The commie block is useful, but the commie block relies on power to be livable.
Well, specifically, not even on power per se, but on these thermal plants. Like it's because they have power plants that generate electricity, and then they have the Soviet Union made a whole system across the USSR of these massive thermal plants that they don't generate electricity, they generate heat, and then they pipe the heat under the ground to, yes, the massive commie blocks, which are completely unlivable without that
in the
heat.
In the winter, yes. They're hot in the summer, they're cold in the winter. It's concrete, right? So here's the problem is that these commie blocks have become, as Ukraine ages and just Europe in general ages, have become like Erstat's nursing home to some degree, like a very elderly people live in these high blocks. A lot of them are not really well liked by the government because they're like somewhat Russia sympathetic. Also, these things now need power for both power and like heat, power for heat. They need power for the elevators, or these things don't actually function. Like these people are can't walk up the stairs. That's a big deal. Like, you will get these people who can't literally, obviously, not like can't leave their homes. Like an old person living alone in Ukraine will just die if they can't. They will have not enough heat. They cannot like reliably enter and exit their house. You will see kind of like it's very corny, like a mass die off of unsupported elderly in Ukraine, and it's like
I don't even think just elderly. I mean, people are going to get sick that are pretty young from just having to live in concrete blocks without it's just going to be very bad.
Yeah, no, it's going to be rough. But like, I mean, you can also like the cold, if you have a shelter, the cold you can deal with as a person with a family, like, okay, you can bundle up and do stuff, there's things you can make, but like as a old person or old couple living alone, you're really hosed. Especially if you can't take the stairs in these can't because it's like you live on floor 12 of this commie block, you can't get up and down it, you need to take the elevator, you're just dead like to some degree. It's awful. It's going to be awful, and I don't know what the like how bad it's going to actually be in practice. There was a lot of doomsaying about it currently in Ukraine, but like not as bad. Like once again, the Sorosites and the big media is pretty mum on it. But yeah, these are three separate, like I would call them like substantial crises that are hitting that I consider like a much bigger deal than like manpower. I think if Zelensky is gone, things are going to get weird. Not necessarily for like in Ukraine, but for the Western, like Ukraine's propaganda in the West relies on them being like the free beacon of democracy, TM. If it's led by a general, dude, it's gonna be super hard to pull that off. And as aid is more and more threatened, there's a situation where Trump wins the election and like the only country giving Ukraine aid anymore is Britain, which is just not gonna work for a lot of reasons that I don't think need to be explained. That Britain cannot sustain. Like the Labour government of Britain will have to sustain Ukraine by itself. It's just not happening. So There's that. I have some tactical. Go ahead.
It's called map posting. It's called we do a little map posting.
Yeah. So how familiar are you with the assault brigades, the Ukraine ones?
I know like the 72nd and a couple. Yeah, I mean, I'm
Well, there's only three. So only three. So yeah. You don't need to know that many. 72nd,
110, and what 47? Is that right?
Third is Azov. Fifth is
third,
the NATO.
Third is Azov, but that anyway. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
So the ones that I'm seeing a lot are, I believe there's only three official ones, but it kind of shifts around on who's an assault brigade, whatever. Is that they broadly have like an assault brigade for every ideology. So there is Fifth, which is the NATO one, NATO model, led by a NATO officer, NATO trained officer. IDR, the like Azov sister organization, their battalion was holding to that, but it's not like a dominant force like it is in Third. Like Azov in Third is Azov, and then the other one is I believe 70 is 92 or 72. That is like the Soviet model. That was the premier tank brigade of the Ukrainians, or mechanized brigade of the Ukrainians, depending on how you call it. It was a mechanized brigade with two battalions of tanks, as opposed to one in the traditional Russian model. That has been downgraded or side-graded to an assault brigade instead of a tank brigade. That is also the one that was very successful in Kharkiv and also like the initial blunting of the Russian offensive in the beginning. Those are the three big ones, and it's interesting how like ex-Soviet, fascist, and like NATO all have their own assault brigades. It's very amusing.
Says, the things that you choose your ideology as long as you do what they want.
Yes. It does seem like these brigades have manpower priority too. It was when Third got fucked up in Avdiivka and they captured that company commander, that captain. He was talking about how he wasn't a member of Azov or even the army. He was a border officer.
Yeah, and his company. Yes, yes.
And his company was picked up because Avdiivka, like Azov rooted off the front to recover, couldn't replenish fully. So a couple of companies had to be like, pulled from somewhere to plus up their numbers. Because I really think of all the brigades, the assault brigades have a lot to do and are very important jobs, and they can't do it at low manpower. They just can't. So they're probably running around at something like full strength at all times because of things like this. Also, you can directly commission into them, right? Like, or enlist into them, and they are like the big, you know, the big heroes, right? Like they're the special forces of this war. They're the Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and it's this situation where like imagine if you told in Iraq if a kid could just like. I'm a Navy SEAL now, you know. Go, you're good, you're in. There's no filter here. It's kind of like that. So like they're staying relatively manpower stable and complete, whereas other brigades are operating at like as low as a third, if not less. So I think the way I'm watching Ukraine mostly now is what are they doing with the assault brigades? Because those are where their focus is.
Yeah, that's where they're actually doing stuff. Well,
yes.
Okay, we'll keep talking.
And currently, where I view the Ukrainian focus is the north, Kharkiv. That's where the assault brigades are going. That's where the ones that are in combat are counterattacking there. They're taking small like bits and pieces. It's obviously push pull, but the pushing elements are obviously all of these assault brigades and a couple mechanized brigades that are like kind of still doing all right intact, maybe kind of questionable. And while these TDF just, you know, hold ground as they can. But it's clear that I think Ukraine views the east as in opposition to the Russian shields as like basically stabilized, like to the point where yes, they're losing like their ground.
Yeah,
but
it's not though. I mean, that's the thing. So
that's where the Ukraine effort is. We're going to kick them out. The current plan, short term, is we're going to push them out of Kharkiv, and then we're going to rotate these forces. We're going to humiliate them. You will be humiliated when your invasion of Kharkiv is, you know, expelled from the borders of Ukraine, and then we'll rotate these forces down, and plug the gaps. That's the current plan.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the plan. Yeah.
And I think the Russians were not. This is where I think me and you differ the most is how how well Shots of VR has been holding up.
Last time we recorded, I agree. Yes, it was going to fall. And I, yes. Well, and it still will. But what I missed was actually, first of all, a little bit of the geography, which is that the
I'm not giving you this out.
Okay.
All right, you're taking the rivers and shit. The rivers, like, the Russians just got to the river. Like, there is the river, which makes that's it hard to detect. But they just got there. Like, the problem was, like, with that is, like, there wasn't the river stopping. Up until this point, the river has been a hindrance to the Ukrainians. Now, like, as of this, like, literally as recording 5 days, they got, they fully, yeah, like, took the well, east bank.
I guess what I would say in response, I get what you're saying and why you're saying it, and maybe this is just a cope. What I would say is, I think the way I was looking at it was fundamentally flawed. Not so much, it was more that, like, a frontal assault on Chasiv Yar across the, like, river, contested river crossings are just bad. Like, it's not a thing you want to do unless you absolutely have to. And if you have to, or if you want to, it's you go want to. For example, what they're doing in the north near Vovchansk, they have conducted. I want to talk about Vovchansk a little bit, but which is the, yeah, that's like the current hottest part of the Kharkov front. But they crossed the Seversky Donets, but well, a couple dozen kilometers to the west of Vovchansk, and they're still in the kind of accumulating manpower phase, because just contested river crossings are bad news. And Chasiv Yar is one of these, like, mid-sized fortress towns, not the biggest, but all of their fortifications are essentially, there's high ground fortifications overlooking the river that flows almost directly north to south. Frontal assault from the, like, going from west to east is just, unless you have very good reason, or there's some, or you're desperate, or, I mean, there are circumstances where it might make sense, but those circumstances do not obtain. The operationally smart thing to do, which is what they're doing, is to go around and find some other place to pick at, which is what they're doing. And in particular, not so much, and again, Vovchansk is kind of its own, and the Northern Front is kind of its own thing. The New York Turetsk line is that's to me what I take as indication of somewhere between, I don't know, I guess it remains to be seen how much of this is going to be attritional and how much of it, because there have been maneuvers. I mean, you were sort of in the chat, you were joking, you know, it's been three barns. It's like, yeah, but there've also been days where it's up to 4 kilometers. I mean, a single day. What were you going to say?
What is 4 kilometers? Okay, so 4 kilometers matters on a axis of advance, a single axis of advance. Like, if I was going down a highway and I advanced 4 kilometers a day in, let's say, Iraq versus America, number two, that's a big deal.
Yeah, 4 kilometers a day. It was a road. It went 4 kilometers. But if you're not going down it.
A kilometer the next day and the day prior to that.
Right. But those 4 kilometers were lines that have been there since 2014. And some of them
the entire Ukrainian army has been there since 2014.
The Ukrainian army was in Avdiivka and Bakhmut in 2014.
All those positions are like it's a bit of a, like, the final fortress from 2014 era, 2016 is
I don't know about final fortress, but
you're coming to my side on this, that, like, you can build more trenches. Like, it's a pain, but it's not, like, impossible. Like, yeah, you build more. There's more. I look at the map. DPA has great, once again, Defense Politics Asia. His map is great, right, because he
defense politics.
He doesn't do. He does the topographical evidence of maps map, where it's like you can see the geography features under it. It's not just like the bare map, and he's updating it or allowing to. There's some of the maps don't do it, but, like, he's just showing, because he doesn't really give a fuck, where the Ukraine. You can see from on the satellite images where the cities are, which are, like, or towns or barns, or which are defensible, but also, like, where the Ukrainian trench networks are set. And they create these, like, almost like square, or like not square, like a grid system. Like it's
oh,
like,
yeah,
oh, it's
no,
a
I see. Yeah, it's good. You can see the lines, yes, and where the
yeah,
trenches are. And stuff.
and
Okay.
and and you look at the front line, and you look behind the front lines. Oh, there's more, and there's more coming. And like there's this stuff that like it's they're not. It's not maneuver warfare. This is attritional positional. That one, the one big, the penis, I believe, has been referred to as.
Yes, the
Yes,
group.
I believe that one was a not maneuver warfare. That was, I believe, that was a tunnel operation, which is not, which is cool. Believe me, very based, like tunnel shit.
It's
Big fan of
okay.
tunnels,
I don't think we talked about this. I don't know if you saw. Sorry, go on with the tunnel. Yes, super
but
based.
it's not maneuver warfare. It's literally the opposite. Like digging a
Well,
tunnel
I
is not
wouldn't
maneuver.
my okay. So thing number one with the Venus, I agree was not. I think that was just a. I just think that was a busted line. I think Ukrainian lines are busting in the 2014 era fortifications. How much they can build up areas behind that, or how much they've already built up, remains to be seen. But I think that we're starting to see the initial phases of buckling. And yeah, maybe they'll be able to get manpower in. I don't know. We'll, TBD on that. Did you see Gostomel Part 2?
No, it was like an air assault thing they did, or
Yeah, well, it's not clear, but yes. VDV in Vovchan.
I did see they were doing some helicopter sh like helicopter attack helicopters have been rotated back to the front in Ru I know the
But
Russians
we
have been
so
using
there was this there,
offensively, not
yeah.
defensively.
Yeah. The for about a week there, the NAFO was like celebrating because there were 400 Spetsnaz quote unquote surrounded in
Oh yeah,
was
this one, yeah, this that shit that I didn't even I, yeah, that's
well it was okay well
yeah.
but so the
Tell the
actual
story.
but the
No, that's a good
actual
story. No, tell the story. It's a good bit.
You don't
I believe
buy
that
it?
was no. I'm saying it was a good not well not the Ukrainian story, obviously. Yeah.
Oh no, not the Ukrainian story. No. Yeah. No, what I'm saying is like so the actual so that yeah, they were saying like oh these guys are cut off and they're all going to die or be captured because we got them in this plant or whatever, but they were actually VDV paratroop whatever air assault brigade meant to be surrounded that essentially it was probably some combination. There seems to have been both infiltration through the urban areas, like Ukrainian held positions in Bovchansk, especially during that initial phase when they were when they were withdrawing pretty much everywhere, and then probably also some amount of like Black Hawk in the middle of the night shit to get that last little leg from the center of Bovchansk to the aggregat plant, and then they just hold up. And because they were in a strategic choke point that the Ukrainians couldn't do shit about, yes, there was an effort. They were on paper, kind of, I guess you could call it an operational encirclement. And there were some amount of problems because of the geography. There were essentially two main streets that Russian relief forces could go down that were both covered pretty heavily by machine gun nests, but eventually those were cleared. And so, yeah, Gostomel Part 2, VDV goes in, air assault, takes the position, holds up, is relieved eventually, 100% according to doctrine. Like, it's just, yeah.
Did you see how they were resupplying them?
Like, oh, with drones, yes, with the super massive drones, yes.
Yeah, and the Russians have. I think they decided to make this. They've. It was during or after they said we're going to like formal. Like it was ad hoc, obviously. Like oh fuck, it's like oh fuck. Find the biggest quadcopter you can and strap like a grenade to it or a sandwich to it. But now they said they're going to formalize. Drone resupply.
They're
There is
not
some,
just resupply,
which is
they're developing
our
them for medevac.
yeah.
They're developing them for
Yes.
medevac to like strap dudes to these
So
like massive quadcopters.
current DJI, the big Chinese firm, is currently has basically this is like the technology is already there. DJI has not rolled it out yet anywhere because I believe it's just like a cost thing. These drones become ex not ex not expensive, actually. I don't want to say expensive because like aircraft expensive does not mean this. These drones are, I think, cost 40 to 80 US thousand USD. But they already have a range measured in tens of kilometers and payloads measured in hundreds of kilograms. It's just a matter of like who the fuck is gonna buy these. Like they're kind of they are the Amazon drones for like big stuff, and they are
Well, I mean,
ahead. They're just
SOCOM
ahead
has
of
been, right?
yeah. They're ahead of the they're ahead of the curve on like who the fuck is, like in terms of like buying enough of these to make it you know scale for
Yeah, but
scale.
if I'm a colonel in the VDV, I'm 100% buying like what dozen or
Yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, these so the technology is there, and I think that they're going to make their own. Speaking of technology, I have been very impressed of late with the Ukrainians' drone factories. They have
I was impressed
basically.
with them. Like, it was cool. Like months ago, I was like, "Well, how the fuck are they?" Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so they are. So the FPV drone, like the Lancets, the Russians have these much more purpose-built, single-use, you know, suicide drones. The Ukrainian concept to counter them has just been, oh, how to make our own. Of course, turns out, of course, the Switchblade drone, the Western equivalent, just is costs at minimum 150K, right? Like it's just not a viable, and it's not even that great. The Ukrainians have created the. There's a lot of names for them. I don't want to get the wrong. I'm sure to call them. No, I don't say. I want to say Muir, but whatever, it doesn't matter. They have basically taken a DJI Mavic. Like the standard small quadcopter that drops a little hand grenade. They have taken that. They have taken kits to build them. And just like, instead of having a drone body, right? Like they have basically replaced the quote unquote, like, which I guess we call the fuselage in aircraft terms. This is now a mortar shell or a deconstructed tank shell. Because there's plenty of tank rounds, right? There's not enough tanks. Too many tank rounds is like a Ukrainian problem. Everybody problem because people thought tanks would be using more gun bullet shooting more than they are. So there's a lot of Western tank rounds, not a lot of Western tanks. So they're taking either mortar shells or tank rounds and harvesting the explosive components. And this becomes the fuselage. It gets a single front-facing camera. It gets the quad. Of the quadcopters gets the four you know attached propellers. It gets a massive aftermarket battery pack slapped on top or bottom, and basically they've replaced the body of the drone with an explosive device, and it seems probably it's more jammable. We know it's more jammable, right? Because it's a of what like it is. It's a shell. It's a kit drone, effectively, but. They seem to work when they work as good as any Russian equivalent, despite being definitely like, much cheaper. The Russians aren't probably spending a ton, but the Russians are probably spending 10 to 40 per like Lancet unit,
To me, the more
and the
salient
Ukrainian
fact
price.
is that they have a production
They have a
line at
lot of them.
all. Yeah, like
Yes, and a lot.
they have actual industrial scale production still of drones, which that's the real
I did the American thing. I used cost as a proxy for being for
point.
product. It's not. It's actually not. It's not how it works. I'm an idiot. Yes, and they seem to work like a charm. As this is, I mean, these are probably maybe more important for other conflicts, but this is as big a jump as like the grenade drop drone. This is like. Industrially hyper simple. Like I hope and pray that Hezbollah is cranking these things out like you wouldn't believe, because there's no reason they can't. There's nothing like you like
Hell, I mean, it sounds like Hamas could do it if they with a little with a little
yeah
relief and time to rearm.
yes and I think these things are these things it looks like it's you can crank out a bunch of these relatively quickly. You don't need to be that savvy. You just need the parts, which are in abundance right now, like tank shell. It's just taking mortar shells and tank shells, and they be
Did
and basically strapping wings to a mortar shell, effectively.
you see the dude who just straight up tossed an anti-tank mine? It's tank mine into a house.
Yeah, they're doing that again. Apparently, that's new doctrine. There's two videos of it.
So I mean, you can imagine. Okay, it's a heavier lift, but functionally a very similar problem in terms of strap an anti-tank mine to a drone. Why the fuck not fly it?
Although, honestly, that's actually very old shit. That's like that's the classic World War II how you clear a house. The old satchel charging it. You know, that's like
sure.
Just but, a,
But I mean, yes, but strapping it to a drone and flying the drone through the window.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's getting wild. It's getting wild. They're calling it like, but what's funny is like that probably constitutes like a what like a 500 kilometer advance as well, like destroying one of these barns, you know. So there is like some cash value in these tactical advances, you know. But I think that's going to be such a bigger deal in the Middle East than it is like in Ukraine. That like it's going to, I don't know if it's too early to be rolled out for this war, but like next war, it's like so effectively like obviously the drone is like as it was the suicide drone prior to the war or during the beginning of the war was like. Okay, this is kind of like the poor man's like ground-to-ground missile, right? It's like a more accurate ground-to-ground missile. It's a little smaller, but that's kind of what it was.
I saw more of a guided mortar shell, but whatever.
Yeah, same thing. Like direct artillery, you know, laser artillery, whatever you call it. This is like the people's ATGMs, you know. This is like the people's javelin at a certain point where it can just, you know. And that's a bigger deal than I think. Like artillery requires complex systems.
Juicy targets, juicy targets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Gaza post war might just like not have internet. Like there's a decent chance that Gaza is just like surrounded by jammers going at full for 24/7. The Gazan border, whatever it looks like, is just like. Going to be jamming towers every 50 meters. Because, like, if you see it,
no, I hear, yeah,
you can hit it, you know?
It's too late, yeah. And if you could see it, it's too late, frankly.
You know, I mean, as the pilot, as the target, as the person shooting it, like if it's within visual range, you know, it's like, fucked. I can also see, like, other theoretical aspects of it, like, if you use a smaller charge. And you could be knocking out like enemy surveillance UAVs with these much easier. It's a big pain in the ass to knock down a drone with a drone. If you drive one of these into like let's say there's the Jews have fucking Reaper up above Gaza, and the Jews get lazy as they are want to do, and they're flying it a little bit too low. You can send one of these with a smaller explosive charge, so a little more range, just straight up and at it, and explode right near it. Like a poor man's Stinger missile. There's the sky is as it were the limit here. These things are gonna this is as significant a development as the IED was, I think. And the Russians are they seem to have been like ready for it intellectually, but I think it did take some wind out of the sails of the because they got so many of them. The Russians have slowed their roll. They were willing to during Avdiivka. Get a lot of vehicles blown up, lose a lot of like equipment in terms of BMPs and tanks, and just like fire support assets, because you know the losses were acceptable for the land taken, the guys being lost could you know easily evacuate. With these FPVs, it's become a lot harder. Also, because unlike ATGMs, which require a kind of a line of sight, these don't require a line of sight. So they're a big, big, big up for the defender. And I think the you're seeing things like these return to infantry tactics and infantry that saddle charging into a building because the Ukrainians were able to make that like BMP sacrifice ratio not acceptable.
They lost a lot of vehicles taking a vehicle. That was a very noticeable
Yeah, and the initial post-Avdiivka push was kind of characterized by that initially. I think now it's become a more traditional. The kind of we mentioned last episode even like they're just up there. I'm sending six BMPs at you, nigger. Like you know, just doing it like straight on the road. Like what are you going to fucking do about it? This is that has been effectively countered by the proliferation of these things. For sure. Also, I cannot wait. Actually, I can't wait. It's gonna suck, but like the way these things work, where like it's a first person like kamikazing it into whatever, and the people using them are like doing hundreds a day because they're like interlinked with like the guy piloting it is further off than whatever. So like you're doing a whole like sector's worth of final approaches.
Yeah.
You're basically
yeah.
like snorting PTSD. Like I need you to crash a plane into somebody and blow them up like 100 times a day. It's like, okay, that's gonna fuck people up. I'm curious to the stats actually. Maybe it's more video gamey, but Predator drone operators did get pretty fucked up. Like even guys in Nevada, because they're like watching a guy for like 48, 72 hours and killing him. That's fucked up. You kind of create a parasocial thing and then you kill him. This where you just like you're just constantly slamming yourself into people. Like in VR, let's say these things were—they're piloted by VR headset. Like the first person means first person. You can do them by laptop, but most of the rigs being used are like a VR headset. So like you are probably melting people's brains who are doing this job, and of course they're also like their own kind of quote unquote celebrities in their own right to some degree. Like they have channels for like that. Battalion or whatever. So like, I don't know. That there's gonna be some stories coming out of this war that are gonna be pretty wild.
Yeah, I saw an interview with a Ukrainian operator. They have like a photo, like a glamour spread photo.
Yeah, shoot. He was young too. He was like 22. It was weird. That whole thing,
like that. Yeah.
The whole thing, the vibes were not good. Like I said, like I mentioned, like bad vibes.
Not at all. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. The whole thing is very weird. Drone warfare, it's just it's gonna be weird. But yeah, I just hope that Hezbollah can do that a lot because that would be awesome. That would make me personally very happy if Hezbollah was cranking out a ton of these Ukrainian style kit. I call them kit FPV drones as opposed to like factory FPV. The Ukrainian factory FPV project failed utterly. Or like they were trying to. There is a Ukrainian like Lancet equivalent, and you just don't see them anymore. Probably because of it's just hard to produce factory stuff without fucking factories, right? Like, is what it is.
Well, a lot of the production, as I understand it, moved underground. But whatever they're doing to maintain their industrial
underground, base, underground Warsaw.
Exactly, but for whatever it is that they're doing to maintain industrial scale production of drones is working.
Clearly. Yeah. Well, it's because with kit production, you can distribute it. So, you could assembly line this, probably make more, but you can also just send all the parts to like a single apartment, like unit, and make, 15 or whatever, and then for that week and send them off, a lot of the way the Ukrainians do like last mile logistics has been interesting. A lot of civilian vehicles, a lot of civilian like residences. So, they're doing it up.
Well, we've gone a while. There's more to say, but I think you want to leave it here for now?
Yeah, I want to cover some. Real quick, I want to cover the Iranian election. Briefly.
Real quick, yeah.
Very, very briefly.
How blackmailed should I be?
Not at all. What are you talking about? So the Iranians have a girl election where the votes don't actually matter, or they matter but not really. Like it's like the joke of like, oh, it's a girl election. It's just for girls to vote and feel pretty and vote for Minnie Mouse, whatever. It's that classic critique of like how you fix democracy, right? You have like a real election and a girl election. The real election happens. The Ayatollah selects who can run, and then the Iranians vote on like that pool. The guy who won is a quote-unquote reformer, which means he's like a pro. I really think it might be a little bit of an ops. Like, oh, he's like trying to break solidarity. Like, oh, the Iranians put a pro-Western, pro-America shill in. Like, no, they fucking did. Like, what a reformer means in the Iranian context is like willing to trade with the West in like trade, like sell oil to the West. Like, wow, it's great. Instead of the resistance economy where they're not as vulnerable, but the guy who won, I never heard of the guy, approved by the Ayatollah for one. I believe he has, he I don't know his age. He's of the age of like acceptable Iranians who fought in the revolution or the Iran-Iraq war. So he's fine on that front, as far as I can tell. Maybe I don't know the name of the guy, but a proven supreme leader. He's a reformer. I would point out to people who would say, "Oh, a reformer means that he's an America shill." The most successful Iranian leader in the last 20 years was a reformer, and he did things that like America loved, like saving Bashar al-Assad's Syria. Like, you know, like the what a reformer is tossed around a bit. Like it's not an America shill. It's a different tendency in Iranian politics that is approved. Like, don't freak out. Like, it's fine. It's not a real election. Like, it's managed democracy. The Ayatollah managed it. It's fine.
I mean, as I understand it, he has the right, and the Supreme Council or whatever has the, like, if they want him gone, he's gone, right?
It's not quite like that direct, but he can be over, like, the Supreme Court, if you will, is more powerful there, right? Like, they can, his actions can be declared unconstitutional. Don't worry, like, yeah, sure, like, he's been vetted. He's been highly vetted. If he's running, like he's been vetted. Like, don't worry. He's a doctor of some kind. I don't know what he's doctor of.
It makes sense. I believe you. It's just,
do not worry.
I guess the worry is, like, why did they vote for him? But I have no idea.
I think as opposed to, like, the hardliners are, like, nerds to some degree, kind of unpopular. It's like, oh, you know, like.
True. Yes, you could see that. It'd be like, oh, my God, these fucking nerds. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was a critique made actually by like pro Iranian Twitter guys who were like conservative. It was like, oh, this guy's a fucking like he was like this doctor guy, whatever his name is. He had like charisma, and the other guy like didn't have any juice, you know, like charisma wise interpersonally. Even though like apparently the doctor guy like fucked up in the debate a couple times. And
what was Ahmadinejad? Where was Ahmadinejad like in the
hardliner?
Scope? Yeah. Okay. All right,
yeah. Yeah, no, that hardliner. The guy after him, though, was a moderate or a reformer. The thing is, reformers, moderates, I'm going to call them. They have this great pattern in Iranian politics. They've won a couple times. It's not a big deal. Where they will make overtures to the U.S. The U.S. press and the U.S. state media will say, "Oh, new reformer in Iran. It's a new day." The same thing they do with the Saudis.
To be gay. Yeah, of course. And they expect them to be. Then gay, they will not gay.
They will. They will have some kind of negotiation. The Iranian will expect to be treated like an equal partner, or like, you know, ask for like some kind of compromise on something. And he will be like vilified into the sun and have his overtures rejected. Like the nuclear deal was probably like the peak reformers thing was like the Iran nuclear deal. All the credibility of which like cratered when like the war when the West tried to kill Bashar al-Assad and it was stopped, and then the Trump pulled out. Like, the reformers basically exist to win elections, make overtures to the West, get humiliated personally by the West, and then devote their lives to the destruction of the West. Unlike the traditional hardliners who are elected, devoting their lives to the destruction of the West. Like, the, you know, it's a subtle difference. They don't, but arguably a more legitimate to, like, it is kind of weird for a politician to come into the world stage, like, really aggro, like, oh, they did, you know, like, you can't, your first UN speech can't be the Holocaust didn't happen, and I love Hugo Chavez. That's, like, your second speech, you know? First speech has to be, like, oh, peace and reconciliation, you know? So.
All right. Okay. Cool. Well, that black pill averted, I guess. I mean, I kind of had an implicit sense. I think, of course, of like the Ayatollah wouldn't let, given the structure of the elections with the pre vetting and stuff. There's no way that.
Yeah. Like the point between guys who didn't pass vetting, Ahmadinejad fails vetting every year, even because it's actually purely personal. Him and the Ayatollah didn't, like, he was a hardliner more so than the Ayatollah, and, like, felt he was being constrained, and this created, like, personal, like, literally interpersonal, like, friction between the two. Like, they don't like each other on a personal level, and therefore he can't run. But, like, that's just the way it is. But he
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think we know that that's a good show. I'm glad to be back. Hopefully, we'll be more back on the
Hopefully, we'll be able
frequency.
to resume a regular recording schedule. We'll see about that. Definitely have to talk a little bit about Israel next time, and I won't be able to talk. Well, we'll see about video games. Maybe we'll figure that out. But yeah, in the meantime, take care and stay safe, everybody.